Welcome aboard, TTA travelers. Whether you're a humanoid, a robot, or an alien passenger.
Etch the memory of your vacation for all to see at Leave a Legacy.
If you had wings, had wings, had wings. If you had wings, had wings, had wings.
We've gathered here tonight around the fire. As people of all lands have gathered for thousands and thousands of years before us.
Okay, the director's ready. Talent's ready. Cue the opening.
WDW Radio. Your information station.
Sometimes part of the magic of a Disney attraction, something essential and impactful, happens before the ride or show even begins. So this week, I'm sharing my five favorite outdoor cues in Walt Disney World, because these aren't just lines, they're immersive, story-filled experiences that make the wait not just bearable, but unforgettable. Hello, my friend, and welcome to WDW Radio, your home and guide to Disney parks and experiences around the world. I am Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 824, and for more than 20 years, we've been sharing our love of Disney together here on the podcast, live video every Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, blog, group events, and so much more. And whether you've been here since the beginning or this is your first time tuning in, you are part of this amazing Disney family and community, and you can find everything at wwradio.com. Be sure to stay tuned for our Disney Trivia Question of the Week for your chance to win a Disney prize package, and sign up for my free weekly email newsletter so you stay connected and never miss a thing. And when you do, you can get a free copy of my 102 Things to Do at Least Once in Walt Disney World book. And if you're looking for a keynote speaker, coach, courses, or conference, visit loumangiello.com to see how I can help you take your ideas and business to the next level, and we can work together to help you turn what you love into what you do. Please connect with me on social. I am at loumangiello on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And if you like what you hear, and I hope that you do, please share the show and tell a friend. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of the WDW Radio Show. Let's be honest, we don't always love waiting in line, unless the line is part of the magic. Actually, that's part of the reason why I wrote my first and second Walt Disney World trivia books, was to help give you and your family and friends something to do in line other than just wait. But I think Disney has obviously improved on this with more richly detailed and interactive cues and other ways to help pass the time, so waiting doesn't feel like waiting. And now, in the springtime, when the weather is just about perfect in Walt Disney World, some of the queues actually become experiences of their own. From the scenic views and storytelling to clever little details, these lines are more than just a wait, they're part of the show. So I was inspired by the recent, very wonderful weather outside and my love of the details, meaning, storytelling, and fun surprises hiding in plain sight. So this week, I'm going to share with you my five favorite outdoor cues in Walt Disney World and why now is the time, now is the best time, to enjoy them. And really, in no particular order, I'm going to share why they're on my list, what to look or listen for, why not getting the lightning lane is actually a good thing, and some of the details, stories, and surprises. And first on my list, because honestly it was the one that came to me first, is the Haunted Mansion. And if I was actually counting down, this might actually be the one that would be number one on my list. Let me explain why. So obviously, unlike in Disneyland, the Haunted Mansion in Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom is located in Liberty Square and was brilliantly designed to feel very time and location specific, but also feel timeless. Right? It sort of melds this 18th century colonial Gothic style with the Victorian and Hudson River Valley influences. So it very much feels appropriate and in place for Liberty Square, but has obviously never felt old or dated. And I think unlike Disneyland's antebellum estate, this mansion is much darker. I think it's more ominous and more aged. And I think the interesting thing about it is, from a setting perspective, it is this Gothic estate but the past is really unclear because there's really no single canon story for who lived here, how they died, why it's haunted. And I think that's by design. And I think that ambiguity invites us as guests to fill in some of the blanks. And we've talked about the history of the mansion many, many times over the past 20 years on the show, but I think it's sort of the non-story story that appeals. And we're not even talking about the inside as yet, but, you know, Mark Davis and Claude Coates, the Imagineers, legendary Imagineers, never really agreed upon or finalized a single backstory that allows the cue and the attraction to sort of suggest a narrative without actually spelling it out. So while, yes, the mansion was once owned by the wealthy Master Gracie, whose tombstone is prominently placed in the queue, while some details and characters and stories have been more fleshed out over time, Constance the Bride, I'm looking at you, others have not. And I don't want to get too deep into the attraction itself, but, you know, if you think back to the original queue, right, when the attraction first opened, it was a brilliant example of environmental foreshadowing, and I think some emotional dissonance, right? You enter through that, you know, wrought iron gate, and you stroll past that overgrown landscaping, and you can almost feel that something is off, and it's very quiet, and it's very brooding. And if you look up at the front door with the black wreath and the columns that are not so subtly shaped like caskets, and then you would immediately sort of come upon the graveyard, were these slightly comedic tombstones with very clever wordplay, like "here lies good old Fred, he great big rock fell on his head," etc., created this subtle, almost conflict, like the Imagineers had themselves. Is the ride scary or is it funny? So the simple cue, and I think sort of the tension that it brought, kept you a little bit on edge and really sort of perfectly mirrored the attraction's tone. Then in 2011, Disney expanded to create this longer interactive queue. And it still takes on that playful tone with the pun-filled crypts and tunes and the musical pipe organ and the haunted books in the bookcase, the sea captain tomb that springs out water, and the dread family tomb with the busts of family members with the clues. I think a lot of guests walk right by, don't realize that there's this murder mystery game that they can play, which is essentially like a whodunit where basically everybody did it in turn. It's a wonderful, low, really no tech effect that adds another layer to the storytelling. There are even more tributes to the legendary Imagineers who worked on the attraction, like Yale Gracie, right? Who the Master Gracie tombstone, Master Gracie laid to rest, no mourning please at his request, is a tribute to him. There was also the addition of the Madame Leota headstone, which is the only tombstone that moves, her eyes open, and it follows you, obviously named after Leota Toombs, the Imagineer who played a pivotal role in the Haunted Mansion's development and whose face appears in the crystal ball in the attraction. And by the way, whose daughter Kim Irvine voices Madame Leota in the current versions of the attraction. And really, other than, you know, the organ, if you want to include that, and the Spectrecom, where you can speak with the nearly departed, I think part of the reason why this works so effectively is because it is about the mood and not the mechanics, right? It doesn't need high-tech thrills in order to be effective. I think it draws you in emotionally through tone and suggestion. I think whether you are a kid or an adult, it makes you start to wonder and try and put the pieces together, like what happened here, what's waiting for me inside. And I think it accomplishes something that's really rare, especially in the queue, is that it lets kids and adults experience it on different levels, whether it's goofy and scary or playful and creepy. And by not answering all your questions, I think that is what helps keep the mystery alive in the queue. And I think if you go at night, you really get the full eerie effect. The fog, the shadows, the lighting is masterfully done. And really pay close attention to the sound design. Not just what comes from the pipe organ, but the howling dog, some of the music that you can hear sort of wafting into the outside queue area. Like some of those like whispers kind of build up long before you enter the building and reach the stretching room. And the reason why this came, I think, first in mind and probably would be number one on my list is because I think the queue masterfully uses subtlety, right? That subtle environmental storytelling that as soon as you pass through those gates, you are transported into this domain where these little details, like the ghost horse-drawn hearse parked very, I think, ominously, but simply out front, right? Its invisible driver suggested only by those little hoof prints that you can see in the ground, the whimsical tombstone, Madame Leota's headstone, and then even that musical pipe organ, while it might be a little bit more playful, I think it gives kids and adults a little bit, especially I think kids, a sort of a lighter entry point and hides some very cool, clever references to mansion history and lore. And so I think it works because it is that buildup of mood and environment more than it is the actual story. I think there's this conflict between the silly and the spooky that mirrors the dual tone of the attraction itself, the Mark Davis, Rolly Crump, Claude Coates conflict that was going on while the attraction was being conceived of. And so what I think makes this queue so unforgettable aren't the flashy effects or high tech or even the linear narrative. It's the feeling that it evokes. I think it lures you in with a little bit of a whisper as opposed to a scream. I think it blends the humor and the horror, the myth and the mystery. It doesn't tell you the story. It invites you to imagine your own. And then by the time the doors to the foyer and then the stretching room open, you're already there. You're already haunted, not by ghosts, but by curiosity. And that's why it's not just a cue. It's part of the experience. And it absolutely earns its place among my top five. Now, number two on my list is going to keep us in Magic Kingdom, but be a very opposite type of experience. And we're going under the sea to the Journey of the Little Mermaid. And I think that this is one of the most visually rich and immersive environments, certainly in all of Fantasyland. And while the attraction follows that sort of traditional dark ride format, I think the queue does a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of setting the stage and turns what could be a very simple waiting area into a fully realized, explorable slice of Ariel's world. And let's start by talking about the setting itself, right? Prince Eric's seaside castle. It is pure placemaking magic, right? You've got the cascading waterfalls and the rocky grottos. It really feels like you're on the shores of a coastal kingdom. And even as you approach the attraction from Fantasyland proper, you start to get the sense of those rugged, romantic coastlines of the kingdom, very much inspired by the coastal European castles. You see a lot of French and Danish influences, which obviously a nod to the original Hans Christian Andersen tale. And even from a distance, as you approach, you see the castle sort of perched up on a cliff above the sea, really sort of punctuated by those crashing waves and the waterfalls and some of the lush greenery. But I think the reason why I put this on my list is because the queue takes you on a journey and progresses like a story in itself that leads you on this almost thematic descent into Ariel's world under the sea, right? You start outside, you've got the rocky outcroppings, the tide pools, the waterfalls, the cool shell and coral formations that are tucked into the rocks. And I love the little crabs that scuttle along the rockwork, both the real and sculpted rockwork. And as you continue on through the queue, you pass the remnants of a shipwreck with the tattered sails and those nautical crates. And they start to hint at the storm that you know that brought Prince Eric and Ariel together. There's some great visual foreshadowing. I think that's happening here. And if you pay really close attention, you can see that the wood planks are weathered and the barnacles that give you the sense of a passage of time and the wear from the ocean. And then you go into the grotto tunnel, which is a little bit darker and helps to transition you from the world above to the world under the sea. And if you really pay close attention, you can see a lot of nautical carvings and starfish and shells built into the walls, right? There's sort of like hidden treasures in these carvings. It's also usually a lot cooler in here, especially in the summertime. And I think those little subtle dripping water effects makes it almost feel genuinely, you know, kind of subterranean. And I love the little interactive element, right? There's almost this crab scavenger hunt that, unlike some of the more overt next-gen queues, the interactivity here is beautifully understated because these little animated crabs will appear in nooks and crannies throughout the queue, which is great for kids because they can feel like they've discovered something, they can point them out, but it doesn't really detract from the other solid immersive visuals around. So they'll occasionally pop out and they'll collect items. They almost interact with the environment and are part of sort of a scavenger hunt type game, especially for kids. But it doesn't stop or interrupt the natural flow of the queue. Plus, there's also the small audio animatronic of Scuttle, Buddy Hackett, rest in peace. And so the reason why I decided to put this one on my list was I think it really helps, and I think my guess is that the Imagineers wanted us to feel like we're walking through Ariel's story, not just waiting for it to begin. I think that's the difference and why I put some of these cues on my list. You're going through the story and not waiting for the story to begin once you enter a building or get onto an attraction. And what I love is this transition that happens from the very bright seaside cliffs. Then you sort of go into these caves. There's a little bit of mystery there. I think that mirrors Ariel's journey, right, from the surface to the world underneath. And it's a multi-sensory experience, from the smell of the water to the texture of the rocks and the ruins. It feels like you're wandering into a storybook before the journey begins. And again, I think it very much mirrors Ariel's journey as well. And like now in springtime with the waterfalls and the foliage and the cool walls, it's a very comfortable place to wait outside, even sometimes during a little bit of the warmer weather. And so I think it just succeeds really well in world building and storytelling and setting the tone without relying on, you know, laying it out for you with dialogue or even pre-show screens. It's a very gentle, very visual storytelling experience that I think complements the style of the ride itself. And I think it also proves that newer attractions can deliver on that classic Disney storytelling even before the ride begins. It's a gentle immersion into the world without rushing you into the ride itself. And I think it's peaceful and it's playful and it's charming. And then when you finally do descend under the sea, like it feels like it's earned because I think the queue has already sort of cast the spell for you. And I can't forget, of course, there's a bonus, right? I think one of the coolest, most unique hidden Mickeys in all of Walt Disney World can be found in the queue, but it only happens once a year on November 18th, Mickey Mouse's and my daughter's birthday, where this hidden Mickey is revealed by the sunlight in the queue around noon. It's tough to see and you have to sort of be in the right place at the right time, but the sunlight passes. It's like Raiders of the Lost Ark. The sunlight passes through a series of specifically designed holes and rock formations. And when it hits at just the right angle, at just the right time, it projects this perfect classic Mickey head right onto the ground. And so this once a year, very short window of time, hidden Mickey is one of the most rare and I think intentional hidden Mickeys you're going to find on property. For number three on my list, we're going to go over to Disney's Animal Kingdom. And while this might not be everyone's go-to attraction, especially if you're not in the mood to get soaked, spoiler alert, Cali River Rapids has one of the most detailed, immersive, and thematically rich queues in all of Walt Disney World. I think tells a very compelling and powerful story, again, quietly, through environmental design and the visuals and the sound, and I think the very subtle messaging. So in looking at why this makes my list, let's talk about the setting first, because the queue is set in the fictional kingdom of Anandapur, which is where you'll also find Expedition Everest and the Maharaja Jungle Trek. And Anandapur, translated, means the place of all delights and is inspired by real regions in Southeast Asia like Nepal, India, Thailand, and Indonesia. And in terms of story, you are about to embark on this Echo Tour river journey operated by the Cali Rapids Expeditions. And the story is really this battle between preservation and exploitation. Like so much of you see in Disney's Animal Kingdom, conservation messaging was very much an important part of the design and the real-world impact that Disney wanted this park to have. So according to story, the Cali Rapids Expeditions is a company that offers eco-friendly river tours to educate visitors and really showcase the natural beauty and the cultural heritage of the region. But as you walk through the queue, you can tell that something is not quite right. Right? Enter dramatic Disney movie music here. There's subtle signs that show you that illegal logging and deforestation is happening and threatening the jungle. And then the story that you start to uncover is one of concern for the climate and conservation and that moral tension without it being overt and almost, you know, overly preachy. And I think like Under the Sea, the Little Mermaid queue, this queue takes you on a thematic storytelling journey. So when you enter the first part of the queue, you start in this rustic travel agency outpost and look very carefully at like the weathered signage, the tourism posters, the gear. It is so incredibly authentic. And you're being told that you're going on this scenic, relaxing trip through the lush rainforest. Everything seems fine at first. And then we see something goes horribly wrong. So this idea of booking your expedition as you first start to enter the queue is this wonderful sort of jumping off point. And then as you walk through, you go into the courtyard of the shrine and there's prayer wheels and offerings and flags, again, reflecting the Hindu and Buddhist influences of the region. And if you look very carefully, everything from the statues to the stonework is authentic or inspired by real Southeast Asian temples. So this reverence that Disney always has, especially in places throughout Disney's Animal Kingdom, the reverence for nature and spirituality is very clear. Like you're entering, you know, for many people, a very sacred land. And then as you start to get deeper in the queue, you see those signs, some subtle, some a little bit more overt, of the environmental damage, right? You see burned trees and the faded posters. And then almost these conflicting messages between conservation and exploitation. And it's not just what you see. You have to take in this cue with all five senses and 360 degrees, because if you listen to the audio recordings, they too shift in tone from very peaceful jungle sounds to, like, if you listen carefully, you can start hearing like chainsaws and machinery off in the distance. You're like, why? This is almost slightly intentionally disruptive. But then as you move on, one of the most beautiful parts of the queue is that when you wind through this abandoned tea plantation, which again, a nod to the real economies of the Himalayas, and you see things like farming equipment and barrels and these handwritten notes to evoke this past life that this area once had before it became this hotspot for sort of tourist expeditions. And what I love and appreciate about this queue is not what you see or hear, but what you don't see or hear, because it never uses a narrator or a screen to tell you the story. Everything is told through the visual cues, the contextual audio, and the contrast in the design. And it starts off very serene, but by the time you get on board, you're very much aware that not everybody respects and appreciates the land the way you and everyone should. And I think, again, it ties into this overarching larger theme of Disney's Animal Kingdom, which is this balance between humanity and nature. And part of the reason why I put this on my list, and again, I understand Cali River Rapids is not for everyone. There's a really good chance you will get wet, which might be nice in the middle of summer, but maybe it's not the way you want to spend your day. But the ride itself, the attraction, although it's very scenic in a lot of areas, and I think that when you go through this almost like scenic start, your raft is diverted into this deforested burning area that's left behind by the loggers. It becomes more of a thrill attraction than it does a storytelling. So I think it lacks a little bit of the nuance and depth that the queue sets up. So the queue is really more impactful from that perspective than the ride itself. So my suggestion to you is, even if you don't want to experience the attraction itself, you can and should go through the queue and take your time. Look at some of the details. Look at the banners. Look at the logbook of previous rafters. Pay attention to the audio layering that is going on throughout. And as I said, pay very close attention to not just what you're seeing, but what you are hearing as well. We talked about the music of Disney's Animal Kingdom back on show 817, but really listen in the queue because the background music is this very carefully, I think, curated blend of traditional Southeast Asian instrumentation and the natural ambient sounds. So you'll hear the hand drums and the wood flutes and the temple bells, but then you also hear bird calls and the insects and that flowing river and jungle ambiance that really creates this tone that is very peaceful and very reflective, which I think is meant to underscore this message of harmony between people and nature. But then as you start to move deeper into the queue, some of those subtle audio shifts start to take place. You start to hear the mechanical chainsaw sounds, the cracking of trees and trees falling in the forest. And the drums and the melodies are almost a little more discordant. Like, they're not soothing, but there's a little bit of like tension that starts to build. So there's a story that you're subtly being told because you're starting off in this very wonderful, you know, paradise type environment. And then something is disturbing that. And then that's exactly where you're not heading away from it, but you're heading into it. And some of those overhead announcements and the radio dispatches help to support that because you're not, and I think they serve multiple purposes. You're not just being welcomed to the river expedition and getting these reminders about respecting the jungle and not littering and things like that. But it also gives you this sense of storytelling that you are really booking a spot on a real tour. And if you pay really close attention, the messages almost to subtly and gradually start to conflict with what you're hearing and seeing because they're talking about serenity, but there's all this evidence of environmental destruction that's starting to creep in around you. So it starts to build this subtle but brilliant narrative tension because while the jungle might be beautiful, it's also under this constant threat, again, something that you are walking into. So the music and narration aren't just atmospheric, they're part of the storytelling, and it's creating this contrast between what you are told and what you are observing, which I think sometimes mirrors the real-world ecotourism struggles. And like everything else, in not just in Animal Kingdom, but throughout the parks, the story is layered, and that audio is almost, it's almost like this invisible glue in the background that helps bind the experience together. So I think the queue here doesn't just set the stage. I think it makes a statement. I think it helps turn what could have been a very simple water ride into something that is a sensory rich message that it can, you know, be a little sobering about conservation and consequence. And that lush, tranquil temple ruin and that peaceful river village slowly starts to shift into something darker. And then by the time you board, you're not just, you know, bracing to get wet. You're hopefully thinking about the world that we live in. And that's why this queue actually matters. And for the next one on my list, I almost didn't put it on. Like, I almost felt like I had to choose between Cali River Rapids and the next on my list because they are so closely tied, not just geographically in the park, but I think in terms of the same type and subtleties and placemaking in the queue, because I'm obviously over at Expedition Everest. Again, why is it on my list? The immersive details, the Nepalese culture, the authentic mountain trekking gear. I remember when Disney's Animal Kingdom first opened, hearing stories about how Imagineers, when they were going on their research trips to not just learn, but curate some of these things, would go to some of the vendors who were selling these items at the base of a mountain. They would just walked in, it's like, we'll take it. What do you want? We want all of it. We want everything because we need to fill the queue. But obviously, it's also about the legends of the Yeti. And I think this is one of the most detailed and authentic queues in any of the Disney parks. And although you're walking through a fictional Himalayan village called Sirkazong, it's filled with authentic and culturally appropriate gear. But as you go through, I think every element that you experience is a piece of the puzzle that is leading you to the mountain. Again, let's talk about setting, because there is this fictional backstory for this legend of the Forbidden Mountain. Again, Anandapur is this fictional kingdom at the foothills of the Himalayas, and the village of Sirkazong, where Everest is located, is this very remote and sacred mountain village on the edge of the mythical Forbidden Mountain. And like Kali River Rapids, the idea that you are going on this Himalayan escape. So you visit the travel agency that is run by Norbu and Bob, a pair of young entrepreneurs offering guided treks through the Himalayas. They've now expanded their offerings to include a little bit more daring expeditions to the base and even through the Forbidden Mountain. And one of my favorite parts of any queue and any attraction is when you pass through Tashi's Trek and Supplies, which is this little general store and cafe and all these other little local establishments that help support the travelers and climbers. And as you move through the queue, you're not just moving through these different buildings and businesses, but you are starting to also get that tonal shift because you start to hear about these tales of the Yeti, the legendary protector of this mountain, and the shrines and the murals and the warning signs start to appear, expressing not just reverence, but I think this sense of fear for this powerful mythical guardian. But he's not portrayed as a monster. He is instead portrayed as a protector of the mountain. And those who trespass and disturb that natural order may or may not pay the price, as you see as you walk through some of the different areas, including this makeshift Yeti Museum, which is this cultural and scientific center filled with artifacts and photographs and some quote-unquote evidence of Yeti sightings. Like, there's footprints and tattered expedition gear and all these blurry photographs and letters from past travelers. And if you wouldn't know the difference and sort of take yourself out of this fictional reality, you would almost think that it was a real museum that was curated by anthropologists and adventurers who were intrigued by and possibly terrified by the legends. And this is where it happens again. There is this tonal shift because it's no longer just this fun adventure. It is this journey into the unknown. And so when you get to that final portion of the queue, it's the boarding station for the old steam-powered train that used to transport tea and goods across the mountain. Now Norbu and Bob, I dig the entrepreneurial spirit, converted it into this scenic route. But you have to obviously be careful because the tracks might lead you a little bit too close to the Yeti's domain. And so there's this wonderfully fun and almost foreboding implication, which is you're entering into this forbidden territory where others have gone, but maybe not all have returned. And I think as you go through the queue, especially in the Yeti Museum, most of the items you see were gathered by Joe Rohde and his team and the research trips to Nepal and Tibet. When you see those colorful flags that hang across the queue, they're not just for decoration. They are Tibetan prayer flags that are meant to bless the land and the journey and protect you, us, the guests as well. Those shrines in the queue match real-world Buddhist and Hindu shrine structures. And then even pay attention to the signage. Like, you'll see signs that are both in English and a fictional local dialect with characters that are modeled after real Asian languages. But I think once again, and I think this sometimes is lost on the average or first-time guest that goes through and is just excited to ride the attraction, the queue isn't just themed. It's very deliberately, narratively structured, right? It's almost like a multi-act play. Like, act one, you're booking your trip in the town. And then act two, you're starting to get these warnings and the folklore from the locals. It's a little intriguing, possibly a little scary. Act three is when you get to the evidence, right? You start to see these mysteries laid out in front of you in the museum. And then that final-ish act is when you board this train and go right into the heart of the legend. I think if you pay really close attention, it builds this dramatic tension like a book or a movie. But again, there's no flashy screens. There's zero technology, right? No animatronics, except until that right before you get into that preload area. It is just incredibly expert use of place, pace, and detail. And so you are not just in a queue, you are on this pilgrimage. You're on a quest for fun. And I think every inch of the queue is about immersion, it's about authenticity, and it doesn't, I think it's one of the queues that does not feel like you're in a theme park. It feels like a real research base that is tucked somewhere up in the Himalayas that's also built with reverence and respect and realism. And the props don't, you know, they don't sort of shout Disney. They sort of whisper that they're real, right? You're not just learning about the Yeti. You're buying into the myth. And then the moment that you step out of the building and face the mountain, you sort of feel like you are a true explorer. It's why the queue is peak Imagineering. It's layered, it's lived in, it's legendary, and that is why it makes my list. And for the fifth and final entry on my list, this one was, it was difficult because I only had five, but there was no way I could not include one of my favorites. Because from the moment you step through the crumbling gates of the Hollywood Tower Hotel, time begins to shift and slip away. And while most people probably think of the interior portion of the queue of the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, which in and of itself is one of the best in any Disney park, I think that the exterior queue is also a masterclass in storytelling through setting. Because you're not just waiting in line, you're checking into a forgotten chapter of the Twilight Zone. And every inch of the overgrown gardens, the dust-covered lobby, and the cobweb library oozes history and mystery and this uncanny feeling, even from the exterior as you approach, that something isn't quite right. And for me, I think that this queue does not begin as you walk through the gates, but as you turn the corner and glance down Sunset Boulevard. I think that there is incredible cinematic buildup to this attraction and queue, because even as you see the Hollywood Tower Hotel from a distance, the cracked tiles, the broken signage, it whispers that there is decay. And I think that the queue itself, both interior and exterior, is arguably the most cinematic queue in all of Walt Disney World. And the outdoor portion, which many guests might either not get to see or will pass by for one reason or another, because maybe the lines are short or you have a lightning lane, is critical to the story's emotional and narrative buildup, because it's not just about the transition between Sunset Boulevard and the attraction. Again, I think it's the first act of the episode that you are stepping into. Because like I said, I think the experience begins not at the entrance gate, but at the end of Sunset Boulevard. The tower is looming over everything. It is a perfect establishing shot, just like a movie's opening scene. And that faux Spanish colonial revival architecture with the chipped paint and the scorched stucco suggests that at one time this was a magnificent hotel, but has been long forgotten. And remember, when you enter the attraction, you are not entering through the main front entrance of the Hollywood Tower Hotel. That's actually where you exit from, right? You exit out of that area into the courtyard. You are going through these winding gardens of the hotel that are very much inspired by the 1930s hotel grounds in Southern California. At one point, you can tell they were pristine, and now they're overgrown, they're cracked. The plants, everything is dying. So you see not just the rusted gates and the crumbling stone balusters, but the dried fountains and the statues that have been sort of ignored and blackened over time. And I love the little wrought iron lampposts that have been overtaken by the vines. And once again, it's not just what you see, but what you hear, because I think the music sets this very uneasy atmosphere, right? I love music from the 30s and 40s, and these are a lot of the jazz and big band standards that you'd hear, like, you know, Mood Indigo by Duke Ellington and We'll Meet Again and Jeepers Creepers, but they sound like they're played on this crackly radio, and it has this chilling effect. Like, it's not, it almost feels like it's not a soundtrack, but almost like a memory that's just sort of a looping memory. So I think the outdoor cue is not just visual, but I think it's psychological, right? I think you're sort of lulled into what should be this elegant, beautiful hotel garden, which so many of those Southern California hotels would and still have, but everything's off, right? The beauty is spoiled. The silence is deep. The music is very distant. You can instantly tell something happened here. And I think what the outdoor, especially if you can go to the entire extended outdoor queue, it's a transition, right? I think that that sort of marks the end of Act One, because as you leave the gardens and then you pass through the arched entryway into the lobby, I think the storytelling tone really escalates very dramatically, right? I think there's this huge sort of break between the outside and the inside because the lobby is covered. It's very, very clear. It's covered in dust and cobwebs and newspapers and luggage, just frozen in time where they were left. And I think you almost feel that once you hit the lobby, you're no longer just sort of visiting and wandering through the gardens. You are now part of the story. And because we're talking and focusing really on the outdoor cues, you're then ushered into the library, which sort of frames what is to come. Then you descend into this very gritty, dark, dirty, almost industrial boiler room. I think there's a lot of tension there. You can hear the hiss of steam and the clang of the metal. But I think the outdoor cue here matters so much because, like a good mystery, like a good horror, it's a slow burn. It starts off very quiet. It's a little creepy. And it slowly starts to raise the stakes the closer and closer that you get. It starts to prepare you emotionally. It establishes the world and the tone and the tension. And I think that weathered luxury and that decaying reflection of the theme, right? What happens when time stops in 1939, but some of the echoes and some of those ghosts remain? And every single element from the music to the flora, to the lighting, it reinforces the story without a single word. There's no plaque, there's no instruction, there's no overhead narration, there's no screen, but I think it is cinematic, layered storytelling. And I think few cues, especially outdoor cues, in any park ever commit like the Tower of Terror exterior cue does. And how that very faded opulence of the garden leads into that very dusty lobby that's frozen in time. Every moment is just drenched in wonderfully eerie atmosphere. It doesn't just set up the story as some of the other cues we talked about do. Like, it is the story, because you're not just waiting for a thrill ride. You're not walking into, you are walking into an episode of The Twilight Zone. And that's why this cue doesn't just set the mood, it unsettles it. Because by the time you reach the lobby, you are already caught between time and terror and memory and myth, and you haven't just entered a ride, you've crossed into the Twilight Zone. Of course, these are just my five favorite outdoor cues, ones that go beyond just the winding pathways and switchbacks. I think they tell stories, set the tone, and pull you into the world of the attraction before you even step foot inside. But there are so many more that could have made the list, and I know you probably have your own favorites too, so I want to hear from you. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What outdoor cue or cues would you put on the list? Let me know. I'll play it on the air if you call the voicemail at 407-900-9391. That's 407-900-WDW1, and let me know. Or come be part of the conversation over in the clubhouse at wwradio.com/clubhouse. I want to hear your picks, your stories, and your thoughts, because after all, every great Disney story begins long before the ride, and yours might be waiting in line. It's time for our Walt Disney World trivia question of the week, where if you think you know the answer, you can enter for a chance to win a Disney prize package. And this week's trivia contest is brought to you by the Walt Disney World Swan and Dolphin Food and Wine Classic, my favorite foodie event of the year. It is held right in the heart of Walt Disney World and combines the best of both worlds, incredible food and drink, and the fun energy, and magic of the Disney experience. It's held on the outdoor causeway between the beautiful Swan and Dolphin Resorts, where you can sample dishes from award-winning chefs and restaurants, sip on fine wines, beers, and creative cocktails from around the world, all while enjoying live music and a one-of-a-kind atmosphere. It is an incredible night under the stars, and honestly, I look forward to this every single year. And tickets are now on sale over at foodandwineclassic.com. And trust me, this is one event you do not want to miss. Whether you are local, visiting the parks, or planning a foodie night or weekend getaway, the Swan and Dolphin Food and Wine Classic is held Friday and Saturday, November 14th and 15th. Get your tickets at foodandwineclassic.com, and I hope to see you there, because I'll be there. Probably both nights. But before we get to this week's trivia question, let's go back, review last week's, and select our winner. On last week's show, I hope you enjoyed our tournament bracket style look at the best of the what's new at the Epcot International Flower and Garden Festival. And your question last week was simply to tell me, in what year did the Epcot International Flower and Garden Festival first debut? Did you get this one right? Were you there for that fateful first festival in 1994? Which blew up into what the festival is today. It really was Disney's first kind of foray into a large-scale seasonal event focused specifically on gardening and landscaping and horticulture and topiary art. And that first festival ran for about 38 days, which is much shorter than the more than 90-plus days it runs today. It was organized in partnership with the American Horticultural Society, topiaries of Disney characters. Really was sort of the visual centerpiece, but there was also a lot of gardening seminars, floral displays, themed gardens, and landscaping workshops, because the festival was never originally designed to include food. But that changed in 2013 with the introduction of outdoor kitchens, and the world is a much better place for it. But I took all the correct entries, randomly selected one, and last week you were playing for a WW Radio keychain, stickers, pin, and a mystery prize. And last week's winner, randomly selected, is Isabella Wynn. So Isabella, congratulations. I'll send your prize package out to you right away. And if you played last week and didn't win, that's okay, because here's your next chance to enter in this week's timely and appropriate Walt Disney World Trivia Challenge. So as long as we're talking about some of our favorite cues, Cali River Rapids, I'm looking at you. What is the name of the fictional river that Cali River Rapids flows through? We talked about the fictional village of Anandapur and a lot of the fictional tour groups. But what is the name of the river that Cali River Rapids, supposedly, according to story, flows through? You have until Sunday, April 13th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern to go to www.radio.com, click on this week's podcast, use the form there. And again, this week, you're going to play for the keychain, the stickers, pin, and a mystery prize. So good luck and have fun. That is going to do it for this week's show. Thank you so much for tuning in and being part of the community and family. I am sincerely grateful to and for you, your time, your friendship, and your support. Remember, you are not a fan, but you are a friend. Next week, I am going to get a special sneak peek at the Disney Destiny on Monday, April 14th. Please follow along with me on Instagram. I am at Lou Mangiello, and turn on notifications. I'll be sharing pictures, video, maybe live if I can, on Instagram. And even after the 14th is over, please make sure you keep notifications on, because the very next day I'm heading to Japan, specifically Tokyo, because I'm hosting a panel at Star Wars Celebration about living your Star Wars story in the Disney parks. I'll obviously be sharing much more from the event, from Tokyo, and of course, because I'm there, Tokyo Disneyland and DisneySea. Speaking of which, if you want to go to Tokyo Disneyland, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Paris, Disneyland, Walt Disney World, or anywhere on this big, blue, beautiful earth of ours, please go and visit our friends over at mousefantravel.com, because for more than 17 years, they have not only been my trusted and recommended partner, but who I have used and trusted for my family's vacations as well. More importantly, their expert personalized service ensures that they take care of every detail so you can focus on making memories, and all of their services are completely free. So you get customized concierge-level service and stress-free planning, all at no cost to you. Again, visit them over at mousefantravel.com. And whether you are dreaming of your next Disney trip, or if you are a creator, solopreneur, and entrepreneur looking to build your dream business, I am here to help. I invite you to please join me for my Momentum Weekend Workshop, Thursday through Sunday, October 16th through the 20th in Walt Disney World. Yes, it is now expanded to 4 days, but it still remains a one-room, 50-person experience for deep learning, hands-on workshops, networking, and real results. Super early bird pricing is on now but ends soon, where you can save $200. We are already more than halfway sold out, so please don't wait. To learn more and get your ticket, visit loumangiello.com. And if you want to bring a little bit of Disney magic to your business, brand, or event, I share Disney-inspired lessons on customer experience, service, innovation, leadership, and storytelling to help businesses, schools, and teams create unforgettable experiences and real success. Whether you're looking to enhance customer loyalty, spark creativity, or lead like Walt, I would love to help and be your keynote speaker for your next event. You can learn more and book me to speak and find out about Momentum by visiting loumangiello.com. And just because it is the end of the episode, it does not mean it is the end of the fun. Please come be part of the community and conversation over in the clubhouse at www.radio.com/clubhouse. Join me this and every Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern on Facebook and YouTube for WW Radio Live. And check out our upcoming group cruises, in-person meetups, and events over on our events page at www.radio.com. Of course, the best way to keep updated and not miss a thing is with my free weekly email newsletter. No algorithms, nothing to check. It is delivered to your inbox every Wednesday-ish. Again, you can sign up over at www.radio.com. And as always, my friend, and you are my friend, whether we have met yet or not, all I ask is that if you like the show, please help spread the word, share the show, and tell a friend. If there's ever anything I can do for you, please don't hesitate to reach out. And always remember to be kind, choose the good, have a great day, and even better tomorrow. So until next time, stay hungry. See ya.